Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Opera News, read by Keith, featuring the January 2026 Opera with Opera News magazine. We'll begin by continuing News Desk. A half-page ad on this page has, as a background image, leaves which appear to be made out of glass. The text reads, Opera and Concert, Festaga 2026. Tickets, Stats Oper, that's STAATSOPER - Berlin .de/EN. Staatsoper Unter den Linden, 28 March to 6 April, with Christian Thielemann, Anna Netrebko, Ludovic Tézier, Charles Castronovo, Matthias Gerne, Julia Kleider. Back to the text. In an interview with The Times in late October, ahead of her new production of the Makropoulos case at Covent Garden, she commented that, across the 30 or so operas I have directed, I have never had a working process free of sexism. She added that she has taken great pleasure from doing the feminist heavy lifting in the sector, but said that most operas are an amalgam of toxic content and beautiful music, and that the misogyny still needs to be addressed. Israeli Tosca gets a new director. Israeli Opera has found a new director for next summer's new production of Tosca. Following the cancellation of its previously planned collaboration with the Royal Ballet and Opera. After Covent Garden withdrew from the arrangement in August, under pressure from Artists for Palestine UK, the Tel Aviv-based company announced that it would still be staging Puccini's opera, but in its own production, which will now be in the hands of the director Ido Ricklin. Venturing into Wozzeck, the Hamsong Foundation is celebrating the centenary of Berg's Wozzeck with in-depth interviews recorded exclusively for its website. Hamsong Foundation, that's H-A-M-P-S-O-N-G, foundation.org, featuring Thomas Hampson, Anya Campa, Simon Keenlyside, and Antonio Papano. Additionally, there are audio extracts from the interview Franz Grundhaber gave to Opera, February 2021, pages 150 to 155, and a memoir of the premiere of the opera from Bertold Goldschmidt, recorded in 1995. Malmö gets sustainability verified. Malmö Opera has become the first sustainability-verified opera house in Europe. In October, it was announced that the Swedish theater had met all the requirements of an audit linked to the international standard ISO 26000, designed to measure social responsibility. Christina Hornell, Malmö Opera's CEO, said, "The performing arts sector has a lot to do in terms of sustainability, and we at Malmö Opera have decided to be involved in driving this work." Tickets for shut-down casualties. Virginia Opera announced in November that it would give free tickets to those impacted by the U.S. government shutdown. It offered up to 2 complimentary tickets per person to its new production that month of La Cenerentola in any of the 3 cities, Norfolk, Richmond, and Fairfax, where the company performs. Holding Up Aida. Next month's planned performances of Aida at the Adelaide Oval and Franco Zeffirelli's Verona production have been postponed due to what the promoter has called unforeseen challenges related to the international transport of artistic assets. The Fondazione Arena di Verona admitted that complications in preparing for the shipment of 28 containers and export delays meant that the production would miss its scheduled shipping window. Dates for February 2027 are expected to be confirmed, though there is no word yet on the availability of the previously announced and starry international cast. L'Opéra en Guyane. November saw the Opéra National de Paris and its academy continue their regional cultural cooperation with French Guiana, which they have been developing since 2022. The first part of their 2025-6 season there featured a concert of French and Brazilian song in Cayenne, alongside workshops which also took place in Kourou. Over the last 3 years, 15 performances of opera, as well as classical and contemporary dance, have attracted 7,500 spectators to the Trois Fleuves Theater in Cayenne, and over 400 free workshops have been led by the opera's artists. Opera America's new leader, Michael J. Bobbitt, has been named as Opera America's new president and CEO, succeeding Mark A. Skorka, who will become president emeritus after 35 years of leadership. Bobbitt, an arts executive, producer, playwright, director, and choreographer, comes to Opera America from the Mass Cultural Council in Boston, Massachusetts, where he served as executive director since 2021. The full-page ad on the next page has, as a background image, a man who is conducting. We're looking straight at him. He's pointing at a score, and he's standing in front of an orchestra. He's holding up his baton in his right hand. The text reads, LSO, the Makropoulos Affair. Experience Janáček's intense operatic drama with the London Symphony Orchestra, Tuesday 13 and Thursday 15 January, 7 p.m., Barbican. London Symphony Orchestra, Barbican Resident Orchestra. Back to the text. Appointments. The writer and stage director, Ted Huffman, has been named the next general director of the Festival d'Aix-en-Provence, succeeding Pierre Audy, who died suddenly in May. Huffman will take up his post on 1 January 2026, implementing the program conceived by Audy for the 2026 edition and in part for the 2027 edition, while beginning to develop the artistic vision and strategic framework for the 2028 visions and beyond. Kentucky Opera has appointed Ben Robinson as its new general director and CEO. Anna Sushin and Alexander Keimbacher are to take over the management of New Opéra Vienne from January 1st, succeeding the founding intendant Walter Kobera. James Gaffigan has been appointed as Houston Grand Opera's next music director. He succeeds the long-serving Patrick Summers and will assume the role in 2027. Alejo Perez has been appointed principal conductor of the Orquesta Estable del Teatro Colón in Buenos Aires. Stefan Zelius has been named as Opera Ballet Vlaanderen's new music director. Currently general music director in Hanover, he will take up the position in September 2026, succeeding Alejo Perez, who stepped down in October. Dirk Kaftan's contract as general music director of the Beethoven Orchestra Bonn has been extended until the end of July 2032. Natalie Stutzman has extended her contract as music director of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra until the end of 2028-9. An image on this page shows a headshot of a smiling man. He's wearing a sport coat and an open-collared shirt. The caption reads, Michael J. Bobbitt, Opera America's new president and CEO. Back to the text. Awards. The conductor Jakub Hrusa has been awarded the Medal of Merit by the President of the Czech Republic. At Operalia 2025 held in Sofia, first prizes went to the Georgian mezzo-soprano Ekaterina Bukidze, who also won the Pepita Embil Prize of Zarzuela, and the Romanian baritone Mihai Damian, both also winning the Rolex Prize of the Audience. Second prizes to the U.S. mezzo-soprano Natalie Lewis and Armenian baritone Grisha Martirosyan, who also won the Don Placido Domingo Ferrer Prize of Zarzuela. Third prizes to the Russian soprano Samira Galimova and Italian tenor Dave Monaco. The Birgit Nilsson Prize went jointly to Natalie Lewis and the Austrian bass baritone Alexander Grassauer. And the Kultur Arte Prize to the UK bass William Thomas. The 2025 Concours International de Chant Lyrique de Canary in Corsica was won by the South African tenor Katleho Mokoabane and the French soprano Audrey Maignan. Mokoabane also took first prize at the UNISA National Voice Competition in Pretoria. The winner of the music theater category at the Deutscher Theaterpreis Der Faust is the mezzo Bettina Ranch for her Kundry and Parsifal at Essen's Alto Theater. In the Best Community and Participation Composition category of the Ivor's Classical Awards, Jonathan Dove and April De Angelis won for Uprising, co-commissioned by the Saffron Hall Trust and Glyndebourne. The New Zealand soprano Madison Nonoa is the 2025 recipient of the Dame Heather Begg Memorial Award. And now, the International Opera Awards. The 2025 Gala of the International Opera Awards was hosted on November 13th by Greek National Opera at the Stavros Niarchos Foundation Cultural Center in Athens and streamed on OperaVision. Konstantinos Terzakis conducted the orchestra, chorus, ballet, and children's chorus of Greek National Opera, joined by the soloists Vasiliki Kariani, Maria Kosovitsa, Yanis Christopoulos, and Dimitri Platanias, in excerpts spotlighting the Greek repertoire, and the prize winners Marina Rebecca and Nicholas Brownlee sang Puccini. In one of the evening's highlights, the great mezzo Agnes Balza was presented with the Lifetime Achievement Award by GNO's artistic director, Georgos Koumendakis. Winners received a marble trophy created by Greek National Opera in collaboration with the Museum of Cycladic Art in Athens, the design being based on a striking early Bronze Age artifact found in the Cyclades, depicting an elegant violin-shaped figurine. Images on this page show first the exterior of a building, it's mostly glass, it's evening, and it's lit up brilliantly from within. In the foreground is a pool of water. The caption reads, "The Stavros Niarchos Foundation Cultural Center." The next image shows two people, a man and a woman, smiling, and they are holding up a trophy. The caption reads, "The editor with Marina Rebecca." The next image shows three people smiling. There are two men and one woman. The woman is in the middle of the group, and she's holding a trophy. Caption reads, "GNO's Koumendakis with award winners Agnes Balza and Nicholas Brownlee." The last image shows two people on stage in formal dress. They are both men. One is standing behind a podium, and the other is holding an award. The caption reads, "Jiri Herrmann and Martin Glaser from the double prize-winning National Theater Brno. Back to the text. And now, the pull of opera. John Cox talks to Rupert Christensen. "It wasn't what I intended at all," says John Cox of the chapter of accidents that led him to become one of the leading opera directors of his generation. Acclaimed for work in a style characteristically marked by elegant design, attention to historical period, and the subtleties of human psychology, he hasn't traded on grandiose or shocking statements, and doesn't favor fuss. Clarity and economy are among his primary virtues, and he's never been afraid of being straightforward. From an oeuvre spanning more than half a century, and created over most of the globe, it's hard to pick out highlights, but one can't imagine how his stagings for Glyndebourne of Capriccio or The Rake's Progress could ever be bettered. They don't make them like that any longer, more's the pity. Now in his 91st year, still spry, astute, and humorous, Cox admits he had no musical education whatsoever, and grew up thinking that he would either pursue an academic career or venture into the straight theater. Born in Bristol, he studied English literature at Oxford University, where he assisted the renowned medievalist Neville Coghill on student productions. But fate took a turn after his own first solo effort, a staging of Ibsen's Ghosts with Patrick Garland as Oswald, proved a notable success. And I was puzzlingly approached by the secretary of the university's opera society, asking me whether I would try my hand at an opera. "You won't have heard of it," he said, "Ernani." "Oh, yes, early Verdi," I replied. The first major accident on my road to opera. To his surprise, because it was a piece very little known at the time, I was able to respond by singing him the first few bars of Ernani in Vola Mai, the opening soprano aria. This was the second major accident on my road to opera. I knew it as one of a collection of very old vocal records that belonged to a master at my boarding school. Because I had some duties that involved cleaning his shoes, and he'd play them in his room for anyone who was interested, I heard, or rather overheard, opera every day. He was so solicitous of his weird hoard that instead of steel styluses, he used specially sharpened thorns culled from some rare African bush. The third major accident. Quite clearly, fate had it in for me. So I took the preferred Ernani into rehearsal over evenings and weekends, and eventually into Oxford Town Hall for a week, performing on a platform hastily converted into a stage. It came off surprisingly well. The most important thing that I learned was that simplicity works. On leaving Oxford, Cox earned his Equity Union card on the strength of this production. In 1959, he took his first paid job, assisting the legendary Carl Ebert at Glyndebourne on Der Rosenkavalier, designed by Oliver Messel with Regine Crespin as the Marshalin and Elizabeth Soderstrom as Octavian, both of them quite marvelous. He returned to Glyndebourne regularly as an assistant over the next three seasons, and after a useful stint in Germany on a scholarship, in 1965, he directed his first professional opera production, L'Enfant et les Sortilèges, at Sadler's Wells. But I was struggling to get out of opera at this point. When I wasn't at Glyndebourne, I was directing plays in the regions, many of them in weekly rep at the Theatre Royal, York, including the first out-of-London production of Pinter's The Caretaker. What emerged, however, was that I was unusual in being comfortable in opera, and my interest in straight theater meant that the managements thought I could get singers to act. And so it came about that I gradually fell in love with opera, seduced by the emotional richness of the music. An image on this page shows John Cox. He's seated on a sofa. He's wearing a white baggy sweater and a white scarf. He has his fingertips held together and appears to be talking to someone off to the side. Back to the text. Cox's pull towards the theater was resolved in the cutting-edge work that he did in the late 1960s, collaborating with an avant-garde group, very much of its time, called Music Theater Ensemble. It is best remembered for a triptych composed by Alexander Gore, offering what Grove's Dictionary of Opera records as a unified evening of experimental theater, fusing Japanese no, classical allegory, and biblical narrative with a tight gestural language. In his review for Opera, Ellen Blythe felt the production deserved special credit for its use of a tiny stage and creation of a world somewhere between peep show and ritual drama, in which comedy, too, had its place, qualities that suggest Cox's resourcefulness and sensitivity. International engagements began in the 1970s. Cox was responsible for 3 shows in the first seasons of the Sydney Opera House, as well as work for Sadler's Wells Opera, newly moved into the London Coliseum, ranging from Malcolm Williamson's Lucky Peter's Journey, a real stinker, to a deliciously witty Patience, with a fabulous cast, including Derek Hammond Stroud and Heather Begg. In 1971, he was appointed director of productions at Glyndebourne, where over the next decade he delivered a remarkable cycle of 6 Richard Strauss operas, their casts often memorably led by Elizabeth Soderstrom and later Felicity Lott. Another accident precipitated this. Cox inherited the first of the series, Ariadne of Naxos, when the Italian director originally engaged was told that he would be arrested for tax evasion if he set foot on British soil. Glyndebourne suited Cox's temperament and mode of working. I understood how the place functioned, and I approved of the way things were done there. I don't know if it's still like that now. Productions of The Rake's Progress and Die Zauberflöte, both designed by David Hockney, were other notable triumphs of this period. The collaboration with Hockney was very happy, he says, even if their subsequent reunion in 1992 for Die Frau ohne Schatten at Covent Garden proved to be one of my failures. It's a pretty impossible piece to crack. I really didn't understand it, and I was having terrible problems in my personal life. David was painting my portrait at the time, and I thought it caught the anguish I was feeling, but he didn't think it was any good, and he destroyed it. Between 1981 and 1986, Cox served as general director of Scottish Opera. This was a difficult assignment, exacerbated by the delicate matter of replacing the long-serving music director, Alexander Gibson. The even larger issue I faced was an institution that was on the edge of bankruptcy, so I spent most of my energy there trying to raise money. My main problem was the obsessive opposition of the Scottish Arts Council, which felt that we demanded too big a slice of their limited funds. They wanted me to dissolve the company, even investigating whether it would be cheaper to have Kent Opera on tour. My fight with them went all the way to Downing Street, much to the annoyance of the PM at the time, one Margaret Thatcher, whose defense secretary was a loyal Scot. We'll continue this article next time. Thank you for joining us for Opera News, read by Keith.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.